Hello and welcome to Dialogos with me, Will Milne, where we speak with some of the most interesting and insightful people in the world today. On this episode, I am so honoured to be joined by Sir Peter Bazalgette, a British television executive and producer, once dubbed the most influential man in British television. Alongside this is his interest in promoting the arts, having been the chairman of the Arts Council. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Sir Peter.
So, obviously, your career has seen the convergence of interest in the media and the arts. Where did that stem from? I read that you didn't have a TV until you were 12. Where was that born, do you think?
I think it was mostly fueled by the winning of a third-class degree in law. Therefore, there were very obvious signs that that may not be the chosen direction that would suit me in life. And the need for another direction. And when I left university, I was accepted on something called the BBC News Training Scheme, which I believe still exists 45 years later. So I went to be trained as a BBC journalist in the mid-1970s.
Yeah. Why did you... So obviously that's the news side. Why did you choose entertainment? And do you think that was a good decision ultimately, since you started out with news, but then you become known for bringing creativity to British television?
This was actually chronicled on Radio 4 yesterday morning.
Oh, wow.
Because I took part in a program called The Reunion, okay, which went out on Radio 4,
yeah,
which is now obviously available on BBC Sounds. And it chronicled the history of the That's Life entertainment program, which I think probably came off air before you were born. But it was on air for 21 years from 1973. And it was a very, very big Sunday night show, which I worked on as a researcher. And they asked me, why did I work on it as a researcher? And the answer was I was working in BBC News and it was stiflingly boring. In those days, the whole newsroom was run by men who smoked pipes and never did a story unless it appeared on Three Wires and didn't appear to do any original journalism. And I got pretty bored there. And I quite liked entertainment. When I was at university, I was, you know, quite into bread and circuses generally. So I asked for an attachment to this consumer affairs program, which was also an entertainment show that ran on Sunday nights that used to get audiences of 15 and 20 million in those days. And they told me I couldn't have one. So having secured an offer as a contract for a freelance researcher, I resigned from BBC News and went off to work in entertainment.
What do you think is fundamental to creating a program that's popular with the people? When you were creating,
it was in my case. I mean, I never made TV drama, so I can't really talk about that. But what was they called factual entertainment was about was about giving people some information that's useful to them, wrapped up in an entertainment format with a lot of human interest and possibly a good narrative. So in the 1990s, I created quite a lot of hit shows, some of which you may be old enough to have caught when they were revived on TV, not that successfully 25 years later. There was a show called Ready, Steady, Cook and a show called Changing Rooms and a show called Ground Force. And these were quite big hits in the 1990s. And all of them essentially had practical information about cooking, gardening, interiors, but wrapped up as a challenge, wrapped up with lots of human interest, personality, humour and drama and a good narrative. And these shows did well. They got very high ratings and they sold around the world. As for Big Brother, and therefore your reference to my involvement in reality TV, a so-called reality TV, you could argue that those other shows had an element of reality TV, whatever that is, to them, in that they involved members of the public, they weren't scripted in that sense, and a sort of challenge and a narrative. But where Big Brother's concerned, I was co-running a production company in the UK, and it was owned actually by the Guardian newspaper. We got slightly fed up being owned by the Guardian newspaper in the late 90s. So we insisted that the Guardian newspaper sold it to a Dutch entertainment company called Endemol. And we became the British sub company of Endemol. And that deal was done, I think, in 98 or 99. And in 2000, Endemol created Big Brother, so we automatically had the rights to it. So I didn't create the show, I merely imported it from Holland.
Yeah.
I notice it's now back on television again, but we started it 24 years ago. And from that came a lot of other formats that you see on television today, everything from Great British Bake Off to Traitors are all essentially programs where you have a number of competitors who drop out of the show one by one, which gives you a narrative arc. All the talent shows like Masked Singer and X Factor and all the rest of it all have this same basic plot, which is that people are voted off the show one by one and you start to root for individuals and so on. And that drove billions of value across the world of television internationally in the late 90s and early noughties.
What's important about keeping shows popular on television and not just having gazillion shows on gazillion streaming services? Is that because I read you were very passionate about keeping the BBC, ITV, Channel 4 at the forefront of what people view. Why is that so important, and why are these shows that you're talking about so central, so key? Why should we preserve them on our screens?
Well, we live in an age of digital plenty, and you can't disinvent the internet. And so nowadays, we used to say we had multi. You know, when I grew up, we had one channel, which was the BBC. When I was born, ITV commercial television started in 1955. The Labour opposition at the time said they would close it down immediately when they got back into power because advertising was a gross exploitation of citizens. But when they got back into power, Coronation Street was getting 15 million viewers a week, so the Labour Party didn't axe it. But you had just had a few channels, ITV, BBC, then Channel 4 and Channel 5. Then we have multi-channel television in the late 80s and 90s. But now we have the digital era of the internet with limitless choice and streaming. And the point about streaming programs, as you know, because you are a digital native, is that you don't need to watch a program when somebody schedules it. You can watch it whenever you choose to watch it. This has meant that the traditional channels of BBC ITV have much, much smaller audiences than they once had. But they themselves have their own streaming services, iPlayer, ITVX, and so on. The reason I talk about ITV, BBC, Channel 4 and 5 being important is that they're called public service broadcasters. So the idea is that they deliver some sort of public good. What is that public good? It's threefold. It's trusted and reliable news and information, which is important for a democracy because a democracy relies on an informed citizenry. I'm talking about that being more important today than it was in the past because the internet is essentially a cesspit. A cesspit of rumour, gossip and paranoia. That is the world you grow up in, and it's available to you 24 hours a day on your smartphone. And so the fact that there are some broadcasters who are charged by regulation, by their regulator Ofcom, that they must produce trusted and reliable news and information is, I think, something that's important. Secondly, they produce programmes which are rooted in our own culture. I call it programmes for us, by us and about us. And that's important because a healthy culture and a vibrant national conversation depends not just on imported shows from the wonderful choice you get on the schedules of Amazon, Disney Plus, Apple, and Netflix, but also shows that are about your own country, shows that are about your own culture, your own issues, what matters to your country as its culture develops. So that's the second reason. First being news, trusted news and information. The second, cultural or societal, if you like. And the third is something I do a lot of work on, which is the creative industries. The public service broadcasters are important contributors to the screen industries. The screen industries are one fifth of the creative industries. And the public service broadcasters are charged to commission programmes from independent producers, to commission 50% of their programmes from outside London. So you've got regional centres of production and so on. So in a whole number of ways, public service broadcasters deliver a public good that I think should be maintained if it possibly can be.
Hmm. So bringing it back to your own sort of developments and what you brought to the UK, and I know you probably, I don't if I keep on mentioning Big Brother, which is only one aspect of a long, long career, but if you perhaps just take Big Brother, how does that fit into what you just said? Would it be the second point? And how does that sort of manifest? Like how materially does something like Big Brother, and I know you've done so much more than that, how does that achieve that?
If you want to talk about Big Brother specifically, which after 24 years since I actually produced it, I tried to talk about it as little as possible. But if you insist that I talk about it, then I shall respond. Big Brother was a program that, when it was introduced in various countries, created shock, horror and dismay, particularly from the older generation, who regarded it as outrageous. So if you read my book on the subject of Big Brother, which is called Billion Dollar Game, published a long time ago now, in 2005, you'll find that it created a constitutional crisis in Malawi. It created a Muslim insurgency in Bahrain. It created a regulatory crisis, a television regulatory crisis in Germany. It created a religious crisis in Mexico, and so it goes on. It's now routine, but when it was first introduced, it was considered shocking to have a camera on people 24 hours a day. However, it had some interesting positives. The first was that it made a whole new generation of people, you will find this difficult to understand at your age, but a whole new generation of people media literate, because it had a sort of documentary style 1 hour of programming edited together every night about what had gone on in the house in the previous 24 hours. But people were able also to watch the streaming from the house. So essentially, people were watching the rushes. And what they discovered from that, and we used to get emails from viewers saying, why didn't you include this? And why did you edit that out and all the rest of it? And you were unfair to this individual. What they discovered was that the process of editing a program is entirely subjective. That no two directors would edit the same material the same way to create a narrative. And quite possibly two directors with the same material would create completely different narratives. So it's an entirely subjective subjective process. So media literacy was a very interesting aspect. Anybody your age who knows how to shoot video on a smartphone and edit video on their laptop understands media literacy and is media literate. But 25 years ago, that was not the case. That was number one. Number two, it was an augury of things to come because it combined the television with the internet with the telephone for telephone voting. So it was a sort of early example of convergence of media in one entertainment product. And thirdly, although its detractors would not like to agree with what I'm about to say, it had quite a revealing aspect of society. The second winner was a gay man who had been demonized by the tabloids, but was found to be a most delightful character and was voted in what is essentially a popularity contest, the winner over, because when the public got to see what a delightful man he was, he won the popularity contest, which went on over the 10 weeks or so of the show. Another series had a winner who was a Tourette's syndrome sufferer who was extremely foul-mouthed and the sort of person people would run the opposite direction from. But he just happened to have particular affliction and was underneath all that, was a most delightful man. A third winner was a transsexual, Nadia. And what all she wanted to do was be accepted as a woman. And she went into the house without anybody else knowing her background. And so in that and a number of other ways, it was quite revealing about how society was becoming more tolerant and more understanding. So that's the case. That's the case for the defence. You'll have to talk to somebody else for the case for the prosecution.
Yeah. I know there are a few on the prosecution, but I think what you say does definitely ring true. Like just showing real people. And when people watch it, I suppose they see something of themselves in that, you'd say.
Yeah.
Bring it back to the importance of PSBs being central to what we watch. How is that looking today? I know we do get quite big viewing figures, but there are obviously big threats from other streaming services. What concrete steps are there? But first of all, what is the current state of it, and what are the concrete steps to preserving the importance of PSBs and not just watching any random thing produced by a foreign company? Yeah.
Because Parliament and society deems public service broadcasting to have a value, to deliver a public good, the idea was to assist it in the multi-channel era. So in 2003, there was something called the Communications Act, and that said that BBC One, BBC Two, ITV, or ITV's main channel, Channel 4 and Channel 5 should have the top five places in the electronic programme guide on the then relatively new services of Virgin and Sky. This is, I'm talking 20 to 25 years ago now. So that's why when you go to the electronic programme guide on your Sky or your Virgin service, you will find the top five channels occupied by the public service broadcasters. That gave them prominence, so if they were easy to find in the multi-channel era. However, that was 25 years ago, and that's become very out of date, because if you go to Sky or Virgin now, before you even see the electronic programme guide, you're going to see all sorts of stuff promoting movies, gambling, video games, and the rest of it. So that prominence legislation, if it still has value, needed to be updated. So there is a new act of Parliament called the Media Bill going through Parliament at the moment, that will guarantee prominence, a new sort of prominence to the public service broadcasters. And that means that when you go to the homepage of the 50 or so services on which you might receive content, that is everything from a connected TV like Samsung or LG to a games console like Xbox to services that aggregate such as Sky, Virgin, Apple, Amazon Prime, that aggregate other services, they will by law have to show on the first screen you come to the offer of the public service broadcasters. It's not entirely clear precisely how that will be done yet, but that will be a matter of law within months. So we have updated and persuaded Parliament to update the prominence so that these domestic services that deliver a public good can still be found. And this should give them a lifeline going forward.
You mentioned on your first, coming back to the three pillars, on the first one, you mentioned Ofcom. How well do you think Ofcom is doing currently at its job? Because I know it comes in for a lot of criticism, especially with GB News. And sort of, I was speaking to Michael Crick, and he was getting very sort of passionate about how Ofcom isn't living up to standards. So is it doing the job it should be doing?
There's a battle for the soul of what we might call impartial news. We've seen what goes on in America with Fox News on the one hand and CNN on the other. In the last presidential election, they both gave up any semblance of being independent news outlets and became tub thumpers for the Democrats and the Republicans in to us in Britain a rather shocking way. And yes, television news, which is regulated by Ofcom. Ofcom has some responsibility now for the internet, but only in terms of antisocial content. It doesn't any internet service can be as partial as it likes, as biased as it likes. But there is this tradition and there are rules around impartial news. And GB News has been driving a coach and horses through it. And honestly, it just depends on your point of view. My point of view is that there is some value to impartial news rules of television because there should be a gold standard of impartiality and you should know where to go, like the BBC or ITV News, to get a service where they've done their very best. I'm not saying they're always perfect, but they've done their best to be impartial, and that has a value in a democracy. GB News thinks that there is a liberal conspiracy in that impartiality and that their views don't get heard on all sorts of subjects like immigration and taxation and other things. And so they've ended up with these, slightly broken down conservative MPs presenting programmes. And Ofcom has been slow to address the issues raised by this. And there are some like Stuart Purvis, who's a professor of journalism who used to run ITN, who's very critical of Ofcom and say that Ofcom should have taken action on GB News before now. And they have just come out with five judgments that GB News failed impartiality rules, but it was a very soft slap across the wrists without a fine. So that is an ongoing dispute. I'm not terribly exercised by it because, frankly, they can do whatever they like on the internet. And so, you know, do I care? I more care about the maintenance of BBC News, ITV News, Channel 4 News than I do about those other services.
Obviously, you've been in the industry for a long time. You would chairman of ITV 5 years ago. You stopped, I think, if I'm correct.
I stepped down about, hang on, and I'll tell you, 17, 23. I stepped down a year and a half ago, yeah.
A year and a half ago, yes. Oh, sorry, what was I? Yeah, sorry, I'm bad.
I became chair probably 7 years ago or something like that, but I was chair for six years.
Yeah. What did that role entail, and how did you, was that a lot of staying true to those three pillars and sort of?
Well, yeah. So I was non-executive chair of ITV. So
okay.
The company was run by its chief executive, who in the most of the time I was there was Carolyn McCall. So a non-executive chair has a simple role of chairing the board, obviously, but the simple role is to agree a strategy with the chief executive, assist the chief executive in executing that strategy, and hold the chief executive and the senior team to account for delivering on that strategy. That's the role of the non-executive chair. Now, the chair of ITV is a different role to the chair of the BBC, because the BBC is a publicly owned corporation. ITV is a publicly quoted company with shareholders and all the rest of it. So it was partly a city-facing job, but partly a public service broadcasting facing job. So it had both those elements to it.
Yeah. And how have people's tastes, do you think, changed over since you started all those years ago in producing television shows? Are they fundamentally the same? Do people fundamentally want the same things? And I guess maybe you're the person, one of the people who identified initially what people want to see. Has that continued? Do you think that's stayed the same?
Well, there have been, there have been lots of changes as technology and production techniques and storytelling has changed. So one of the big changes, and you alluded to it yourself earlier, is the appearance on TV of people in their own right. In documentaries made in the 1930s and game shows made in the 1960s, members of the public appeared as ciphers. Really, they were told, they're given one line to say, which is, good evening, you know, what are your hobbies? Oh, I like making tea and betting on the dogs. Yeah, fine. But exploring members of the public or real people, as sometimes some people call them in a rather bizarre phrase, they've come into their own in reality shows and such like. Another a big trend that's changed is that drama has developed into this compelling box set era, which drives the financial model of the streamers with 8 or 10 episodes, which you can binge watch. That's a completely new phenomenon. And therefore, there's an amazing demand for strong narratives, and people are mining old books. The book I wrote about Big Brother in 2005 has been picked up 17 years later. And somebody's given me a rather tidy sum of money for the rights to it, because it's a narrative about something, and everybody's after narrative. So that's another big change. The idea of subscription is another huge change. So there were no such things as subscriptions. There were for other things like publications, but not for TV and radio. But now you subscribe and you pay for the likes of Netflix, Amazon, and the rest. So there are all sorts of massive, massive changes.
Yeah. Obviously, well, you were chair of Arts Council England, and that obviously, I think you must have an interest in getting people into the creative industries. What is the talent pool like within public service broadcasters, and what's the are we doing enough to encourage people to enter the creative industries? I'm speaking specifically about the media, or are we not going to schools and telling people that this is an industry that you can enter and have a great time in, if that makes sense? So that's a bit of a rambly question.
We were the first country in the world to define an industrial sector called the creative industries, which was happened in the late 90s under the new Labour government. And now most countries in the world have defined such a sector. It's rather a potpourri, because it's defined by any output that has creative input into it, but it includes the likes of advertising and marketing, video games, screen like film and TV, fashion, architecture and design, publishing. So it's a whole range of different subsectors. So I currently chair something called the Creative Industries Council, and our job is to liaise with the government on behalf of the sector to drive more sector-friendly policies. For instance, there is a subsidy on making films and television drama and video games in our country. And the reason there is because these things are to be encouraged, but also because other countries have the same thing. And if we didn't have it, we'd lose the business to our countries abroad. And so I chaired the Arts Council, which is one element, which is the visual arts, the performing arts, and the public subsidy that is put into them via the lottery and the taxpayers' money. But that is a subset of the broader creative industries. So because I worked in TV on the one hand, and I worked at the Arts Council on the other hand, I got a sort of view across this new sector called the creative industries. And so that gives me perhaps an understanding and a particular interest in promoting it. And the creative industries in general are now about 6% of the economy, and they grow much faster than the economy in general. So they are one of the hopes for future growth.
Yeah. It's the classic question. What's the threat you think AI poses to these creative industries? Do you think they'll remain thriving? Or I guess it depends what specific section of that industry you're talking about, or will human creativity remain central?
Yeah. So generative AI, which is the sort of new kid on the block, has many, many benefits for the creative industries. I mean, if you think about the fact that an advertising company may wish to reversion It's promotional material for 86 different countries. AI can just do that in a way that would have been labor intensive a few years ago. So there are lots of benefits in it, but there are issues around whether we want machines inventing messages for human beings. There's some sort of philosophical, profound philosophical issues around that, which I'm not going to unpack now. I will leave you to write a learned dissertation on it. As a leading student of the British university sector. But the more pressing challenge is that generative AI depends on machine learning. And machine learning has the potential to drive a coach and horses through copyright. And copyright and IP protection, intellectual property protection, is the lifeblood of the creative industries. You create something and your ability to defend your own creation legally is the difference between making a living and not making a living, whether you are in the screen industries, whether you're in video games, whether you're in fashion, whether you're in publishing. It all depends on IP protection, and generative AI depends on machine learning, which just basically thieves the material from those sources and then reversions it into a sort of software created hodgepodge. And so that's a real challenge, and we're seeking defences and rules and revisions of the Copyright Act, but it's proving quite difficult to negotiate.
I think obviously ChatGPT had the problem with the New York Times. I think they were just borrowing loads of their material when the New York Times were going to, I don't know if it happened, but they're going to sue the New York Times. So
there are various legal actions going on, but you can't settle this with lots of legal actions. We'll all be in court for the rest of our lives. So you do need the copyright laws updated. And there are some agreements. The Axel Springer newspaper group in Germany has made an agreement with Generative, one of the Generative AI services, that they pay them some money for allowing them machine learning access to their material. But that's a one-off agreement. What you need is some broad agreements. That's work in progress.
Looking over your career so far...
I should just add, if it's any value to you, I had to give a little speech about this question of AI and copyright infringement recently. And what I did was I asked the three AI apps on my phone, was AI a threat to intellectual property? And they all agreed it was. So my point of my speech was that if AI says AI is a threat to IP, we should take it seriously.
You can get in these weird, with AI, you can get in these weird discussions with it where you're trying to convince AI of something. It's quite an interesting sort of thing. It's not based on truth, is it? It's just based on what's most probable. So that's a big problem. But anyway,
generative AI services are going to get better and better because they look. I mean, the other day I asked one of my apps for a couple of pubs that I could have lunch in close to something I was visiting in East London. And it immediately gave me two pubs. And when I looked one of them up, it was nowhere near it. So I went back to it and I said, actually, that pub is nowhere near such and such. And it came back and said, oh, you're quite right. I'm terribly sorry. So that's machine learning. It will get better.
Looking back on a lot of your career and what you're doing and going, what do you think so far is your greatest achievement? Or do you have a few? Or is there one singular impact that you think you've had that you're very proud of?
Well, I was lucky enough to create a few hit shows, and they're as rare as hen's teeth, having a hit. So I created a few hit TV shows in the 1990s. That's one thing. Another thing would be persuading, when I was chair of the Arts Council, the then Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, that he should extend so-called tax credits, which I've talked about in relation to the video games and television drama and movies, to extend that to the publicly supported arts, opera, theatre, excuse me, orchestras, museums, and that brought a lot more money into the arts than was previously going in. So I was very pleased about that. And then lastly, I think I would mention, although it's not my achievement, it merely happened while I was chair of ITV, the modernisation of ITV, which was quite a traditional broadcaster and had to modernise its advertising so that it could compete with Google and Facebook in offering targeted impacts and programmatic buying. I won't unpack what that is, but it's the modern way of selling advertising. And in modernising its streaming service, so it was a modern consumer-focused, data-led service, which is what ITVX is. Those would be a few of the things I might mention.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being willing to be interviewed. It's been a great honour to interview you. And yeah, thanks for those contributions to the creative industries. And yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to that interview with Sir Peter Bazalgette. I hope you enjoyed it. And yeah, keep following the podcast for more interviews with more fascinating people. Thank you.